Thank you, Mr. Vogel. Members of the Vancouver Institute and friends, it's a great honor when Mrs. Demetz called me and asked me to give this talk. The last time I was here, probably at this podium, at least it was in this building, in 1980 when the Dalai Lama was lecturing in the same forum. And I was translating. I remember I was standing about over there and I had a microphone in one hand and a glass of water in the other. And he made me work so hard I drank all of the water. The topic tonight is concerned with the very foundation, the very basis of Buddhism, no matter what country it had spread after its origin in India. Buddha, as you all know, is thought by, at least in some systems, to have died at around 483 BC. Some people say a good bit earlier, and some have small quarrels about the specific number. It spread throughout Asia. The particular type of Buddhism that I have spent my time studying is that known in Tibet. The Tibetan Buddhism spread into Mongolia in an area that stretched from the Caspian Sea, where it empties into the Volga River. One of my teachers was from there, Astrakhan, really in Europe, and all the way over to Siberia. The Mongolians sent their young monks to Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, to study Buddhism, much as Catholics do to Rome. And people often stayed on in Tibet. Sometimes they went back home. Then as the communists took over Russia, and then Inner Mongolia, Outer Mongolia, and so forth, more and more of these people stayed, of course, in Tibet, moving eventually to India when that country was also lost to the Chinese communists. I began studying, as Mr. Vogel said, back in 1963 with this Mongolian Lama from Astrakhan. And some 21 years later, I'm still studying, and I get more and more interested as time goes by. I find that rather amazing, because you usually wear out things in time. Now the topic, compassion and wisdom. Wisdom is of selflessness, of emptiness. So it often appears, how could it possibly go together with compassion? People usually take the term selflessness to refer to personlessness, as if there were no persons, and emptiness to refer to an utter void that negates all phenomena whatsoever. In which case, how could there be anyone to have compassion for anyone else? A very good question. Now, I'll be speaking to this question from the point of view of a 7th century Indian philosopher, Chandrakirti, Buddhist philosopher, who is said to have lived for 300 years and is said to still be around in a rainbow body. So we can tell from that emptiness does not mean nothingness. It may mean something that at least the system holds. If you realize it thoroughly, you can so transform mind and body that it's possible to live in a type of body and with a type of mind that can go on, I guess, forever. However, it can be for other people. We can just think that he lived in the 6th century. Some people say the 7th century AD. I'll also be following commentaries by a lama in Tibet who founded one of the orders. His name is Tsongkhapa. He lived at the end of the 14th and the beginning of the 15th century. What Chandrakirti does at the beginning of his commentary or his introduction or supplement to Nagarjuna's treatise on the Middle Way, Nagarjuna being the founder of the Middle Way school of Buddhist philosophy, what Chandrakirti does at the beginning is to pay homage to compassion, quite contrary to the usual custom of paying homage to Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, or other practitioners. Chandrakirti instead pays homage to compassion, because compassion is the source of bodhisattvas, and bodhisattvas are the source of Buddhas. Bodhisattvas are Buddhas to be, persons who have generated compassion to a full extent in their continuums and are still practicing on the path in order to become Buddhas. Chandrakirti bows down to, pays homage to, compassion at the beginning of his text. He teams his description of compassion together with wisdom, and thus I'm using these few verses at the beginning of his supplement or introduction to Nagarjuna's treatise on the Middle Way as my text tonight. He differentiates between three different types of compassion. The first he calls compassion observing suffering beings. Now, the way wisdom is used here is to investigate the nature of ordinary life, the actual condition of life, so that one understands one's own suffering and in turn the suffering of other beings. It is said that when one fully understands one's own suffering, one develops a wish to get out of samsara or cyclic existence, or you could say the cyclic mess, perhaps, that ordinary beings are usually in. And when one extends that understanding of one's own condition of suffering to others, one generates a sense of compassion. Compassion being defined as the wish that other beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Thus, wisdom is needed in order to probe the depths of suffering, in order to make sure that one identifies the full scope of suffering. Chandrakirti uses a metaphor at the beginning of this text to illustrate the type of suffering that beings have. He compares beings to buckets in a well. I will just mention in passing there's some dispute as to whether the buckets in the well here refer to one bucket that's going up and down a long well, or whether it's a water wheel with several buckets strapped to it with ropes and which dips down into a shallow well of water and scoops it up as for irrigation. In any case, the bucket is bound by a rope to the windlass or to the wheel on which if it's a water wheel, just as in the Buddhist system, it is conceived that beings like us are bound by afflictive emotions, such as desire, hatred, enmity, jealousy, and so forth, and we're bound by the actions, karma, that those afflictions induce. In other words, out of desire, hatred, enmity, jealousy, belligerence, spite, there's a list of 6 major afflictions and 20 minor ones. Out of all of these, we engage in activities, and those activities deposit potencies in our minds, according to the system. And at the time of our death, some of these potencies become activated, and we are drawn into another lifetime due to those potencies. I remember reading that Thomas Edison believed that there were molecules of electricity at the heart on which all of our deeds were etched, and that these molecules at the heart left at the time of death and went on to the next lifetime. It's quite similar. Buddhists posit many different means of connection between the last life, between this lifetime and the next lifetime, between the last lifetime and this lifetime. Sometimes it's a consciousness, Sometimes it's the mere person itself. Sometimes it's the fundamental innate mind of clear light that is, so to speak, etched or infused with these potencies. So just as the bucket is bound to the windlass, or just as the scoops are bound to the wheel with rope, so beings are bound in the cyclic process of existence through their own afflictive emotions of desire and hatred, and the actions, karma, that these afflictions give rise to. The word karma comes from the Sanskrit verbal root kur, which simply means to do. Karma is action, and by extension, it is the potencies or predispositions that are established on the mind or in the mind by those actions. Also, just as the bucket has an operator, just as the windlass has an operator or the wheel has an operator, one's cyclic existence is impelled by the mind, by an untamed mind. The mind is the force behind everything. It is in this sense that even all of the Buddhist systems can be considered to be idealisms. Not in the sense that there's no external world, but in the sense that the mind, the spirit behind one's activities is the most important factor. So that's the second comparison with the well. The third is that just as the bucket travels in the well, so beings wander in cyclic existence. Just as the well has a top light part and a bottom dark part, so in this world of cyclic existence, of lifetime after lifetime, there are better and worse rebirths. There are births as hell beings, hungry ghosts, animals, humans, gods, and demigods. The first three being in the dark part of the well, and the last three being at the top part. But they're all caught in the well. They're all part of the well. Just as the bucket can only wander in the well, if we stretch our metaphor some, I don't know why you couldn't take it away, but in any case, just as the bucket only wanders in the well, so beings only wander in these types of cyclic existence. One text compares this type of wandering to a fly being caught in a jar. It can move from the top to the bottom, around, and so forth, but it is always caught in the jar. Then the fourth comparison is that just as the bucket descends easily but is raised with difficulty, so a being easily is impelled into bad actions, unskillful actions, unvirtuous actions that establish bad potencies in the mind that lead to a lower rebirth in the future. You can see that if one takes this seriously about the condition of us human beings in this world, one gets a strong sense, a powerful sense of the depth of suffering that we have to undergo, lifetime after lifetime. So just so it is difficult, it is easy for beings to engage in actions like desire and hatred and thereby imprint their mind with potencies that will draw them downwards in the future. And it is hard to engage in virtuous activities such as ethics, charity, patience, and so forth, love, compassion, that will lead to higher states. A Buddhist lifetime by no means begins with a clean slate. Begins with a slate that's very cluttered from other lifetimes. Then the fifth comparison is that just as the buckets, now here you really have to use the metaphor of the circular water wheel with several buckets on it, just as they are continuously in multiple operation, one is going into the water, one is rising up, another one is emptying itself out. So a being who is caught in this type of cyclic existence has been impelled into it by actions from a former lifetime, but is engaging in new actions during the lifetime over and over that establish potencies that will lead to other lifetimes in cyclic existence. It's much like the potencies that lead to our own dreams when we sleep at night. There are certain factors in mind that become activated during dream time that lead to dreams of a certain length of time, and when its force is used up, the dream ends and a new dream begins, impelled by another potency. The view of our lives in this sort of endless, not really endless, but beginningless cyclic existence is quite similar. The sixth comparison. The bucket, as it travels up and down the well, here's where I think it's better to view it as a well, a deep well, it's continuously battered. As it goes down, it hits against the side, it's bruised, it's broken, it develops cracks and so forth. One of my teachers, a Tibetan Lama, who was born around, it was 1900 or 1901, he's since passed away, born in Lhasa, he was an actor as a child, and he would carry on quite a bit at this point, making noises about how the bucket went down in the well, drrr, clang, clang, and so forth. I'm sure he didn't say clang, clang, that's from English, but things like that. And sitting in front of him, I couldn't help after a while but start to feel sorry for that bucket. So that meant he was succeeding. So through these six points of comparison, the meditator is supposed to reflect on the example and extend it to first himself or herself and then other beings. And as much as one could feel the metaphor, feel the bruise and batter of the bucket in the well, so much can one feel the bruise and batter of beings in this cyclic existence. So, it takes wisdom to, on the level of hearing, first of all, to get straight the six parts of the metaphor. It takes wisdom of hearing and thinking to be able to put together how these are applied to other beings. It takes wisdom arisen from meditation in order to apply these in an intimate and feeling way to one's own situation in cyclic existence and to extend it to others. So this is wisdom working for the sake of compassion. Wisdom enhancing the compassionate consciousness. It not being sufficient merely to understand that there are some types of suffering, such as physical and mental pain. It's necessary to understand also that the type of happiness that beings have in this sort of cyclic existence is not final, does not have an inherent nature of pleasure. As they say, if it did, one could partake of whatever it was that was pleasurable endlessly, and it still should be pleasurable. I don't know if there's anything that can bear that up. If you eat pizza, you cannot go on eating pizza all evening. This kind of talk is sobering, isn't it? Albert Schweitzer, when he went to India, he wasn't encountering Buddhists, but he became quite discouraged. So though they're so pessimistic, I can understand why he would think that. But really, the extent to which one identifies the scope of suffering, as long as you're positing that there's a means of overcoming that suffering, so much more optimistic then really is that system. Also, the system is not encouraging that people become overly or morbidly fascinated with suffering. but merely assess the situation as it actually is so that they can then become more capable of wisely dealing with it. As the Dalai Lama said one day in India, it really made me sit up in my chair. He said, our type of life has a nature of suffering much as fire has a nature of heat. You pretty much can only learn to handle it. Pretty much means that they do posit deeper states of meditation and so forth that make it possible to overcome it entirely. So, the first type of compassion is the wish that other beings be free from suffering and causes of suffering. Suffering being understood to be not only physical and mental pain, but also the suffering of change, that is to say, ordinary worldly pleasures, and beyond that, the suffering of merely having this kind of mind and body that is susceptible to pain, of being caught in a process of being under the influence of a process of afflictive emotions and contaminated actions, actions that are contaminated by these afflictive emotions. Understanding that sentient beings, that living beings have these types of suffering, generating the wish that they be free from them and that they have the causes for such. On the subjective side, the thought that the meditator is supposed to cultivate is of three types. One is the wish, how nice it would be if beings were free from suffering and the causes of suffering. The second, a bit stronger, is may beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And the third, which marks the heroism of the bodhisattva, is I will free beings from suffering and the causes of suffering. It's unusual, extraordinary. It's the willingness, if one had to do it alone, to be willing to do so. The willingness to do it alone if one had to. One, of course, doesn't have to. Then, the second type of compassion about which Chandrakirti speaks. The second he calls compassion observing suffering beings who are qualified with impermanence. He uses as his metaphor here a moon, the reflection of a moon in a lake that is stirred by a slight breeze. So he's using the metaphor for the sake of meditation. If the lake were calm, the moon would just appear to be a moon. But given that there's a slight breeze and there are ripples on the water, the moon appears to be evanescent, to be shining, to be, I don't know what words to say, I can only do this with my hands. So now, in meditation, and he's suggesting that the people in this tradition, in meditation, reflect on such a moon and what it looks like, and then apply this to beings. In other words, beings are as evanescent, as shimmering, as changing, as transitory as the moon, the shimmering moon in the rippling water. This is impermanence. In other words, the meditator must use wisdom to penetrate the impermanent nature of produced phenomena, like one's body, mind, this world system, you know, mountain, sun, moon, world system, Milky Way. They didn't posit the Milky Way, but we may as well. Carl Sagan would have a good time with it, I think. Impermanence. We generally conceive of impermanence to be a matter of having some entity or some substance on which other factors act, causing it to change. We have a piece of iron. I remember as a child looking at a piece of iron and noticing that it was becoming rusty and thinking about what was acting on it from the outside. It was water acting on it from the outside. Well, that's one type of impermanence. It's coarse impermanence. From the Buddhist point of view, the more subtle impermanence is the fact that the very nature of produced phenomena is to disintegrate. All that is required for their disintegration is their own production. Nothing is required further for something to disintegrate than for it to be produced. It's from this point of view that it's said that disintegration is uncaused, meaning it has no separate cause from the production of that phenomenon. The causes that produce that phenomenon cause it to disintegrate. And they posit that the disintegration of the phenomenon takes place simultaneously with the production of the phenomenon. In other words, interpreting disintegration to mean that the phenomenon will not last for a second moment. The non-lasting of that phenomenon for a second moment is its disintegration. That's an interesting idea. And if the process of causation that the particular phenomenon is involved with is one stemming from desire, hatred, enmity, jealousy, and so forth, then that process of disintegration will necessarily lead to devolution, to a turning, like old age, to a worsened state. It's a fascinating idea. That there's a subtle impermanence. One of my teachers, Tibetan teachers, said that in the time it takes a healthy person to snap his fingers, I don't know if I'm healthy enough. Well, you blink the eyes at the same speed, he said, as you snap the fingers. I'm not quite certain. If you break this into 360 portions, everything, all of these phenomena are disintegrating at that rate. Well, it's much faster than that from the point of view of Western science. But here, the meditator is to take such rapid disintegration into account with respect to that meditator's emotional life. We sometimes put science on one, sometimes, some of us. Science on one side and the emotions on another side, and it's almost as if there were two worlds which operated by different rules. Whereas in this system, one is intended to bring one's understanding of such impermanence on the level of particles or molecules to one's vivid understanding of oneself, one's own body, and of everyone else. For instance, I was talking at the beginning about being here 4 years ago as if I were the same fellow and that this was the same room where the Dalai Lama spoke 4 years ago. I mean, my Lord, it's the molecular structure of everything has been changing, and so forth. And even with a little bit of wisdom, I could examine my own body and realize that it's a little bit worse off than it was 4 years ago. So that's why Chandrakirti uses this example of the reflection of the moon in rippling water. You see, it is rapidly going like so. And he's advising meditators to view their own bodies, minds, and so forth, and others in this way. Now, the prime meaning of meditation is said to be to become accustomed, to become familiar with something that one has already decided through hearing and thinking. It being very dangerous just to meditate on anything, since no matter what you meditate on, you can eventually see it. If you want to imagine you have a horn growing out from the top of the head, in time you can meditate and see a horn growing out of the top of your head. So the practitioner is warned to use wisdom, to use sharpness of mind, to use the ability to differentiate and discriminate in order to decide, first of all, through hearing and thinking, what that meditator wants to meditate on. So here, Chandrakirti provides a metaphor, not just for the sake of drawing a metaphor, but for the sake of meditation, in order to get used to, become acquainted with, familiarize with, become accustomed to impermanence, and then to view one's own body and mind and others' bodies and mind in that way. You see, he calls the second compassion, compassion observing sentient beings qualified with impermanence. This means that for the practitioner, the other beings are seen, oneself and others, are seen not just as suffering in the ways illustrated through the bucket in the well, but also as being in a condition of impermanence. Now, because we conceive of the opposite, because we conceive that I'm the same, I conceive that I'm the same person that I was four years ago, I'm out of tune with reality. I'm out of tune with the basic impermanent nature of my own physical and mental structure. And by being out of tune with that, I conceive a type of selfhood or personhood or I-hood that is far more concrete than that which actually exists. So even if Buddhism is a wisdom of selflessness, that self means an exaggerated sense of self beyond what actually is. It doesn't mean that there are no selves. There may be no self like the one one is so familiar with, or the one conceives under pressure. But there is a self. Therefore, selflessness refers to this absence of such a concrete being. So because we conceive of concrete beings and seek to fulfill the wishes of such a concrete being and thereby engage in hatred and so forth, in order to protect those wishes, in order to protect the attainment of those wishes, the meditator generates even more compassion. The wisdom penetrating the impermanent nature of phenomena enhances the compassion. What's so interesting to me, coming out of English literature, psychology, and so forth, is the usage of metaphor to not just to bring home the point in the literature, but to bring home the point in meditation. What little I've tried of this meditation is quite frightful. I learned very quickly why it said that over the course of years of meditation, one has to develop facility, patience, forbearance with impermanence. In other words, impermanence scares the life out of you. So, wisdom being used in meditation to enhance compassion. Then the third type of compassion. Chandrakirti calls it compassion observing sentient beings, suffering sentient beings, qualified with emptiness. The word sentient just slipped in. I've been trying to keep it out of my vocabulary tonight. Us Buddhist scholars are quite accustomed to using the term sentient being, which just means thinking being. But I've found that many people, sometimes students, even after 3 or 4 months, haven't the faintest idea what I've been saying. Once I got a paper back about, instead of bodhisattvas, a paper about Buddha zankas. And the Buddha's Sanghas were having compassion for beings caught in, not in cyclic existence, but in sickly existence. Which wasn't so bad. So I took to writing things on the blackboard. Compassion observing suffering sentient beings qualified with emptiness. Now, for this, Chandrakirti uses the metaphor again of the reflection of the moon in the lake, but this time of the reflection of the moon in a still lake, a calm lake, breezeless lake. Now, I don't know. Have you ever looked in a lake and thought it really was the moon? It's a bit difficult. With a mirror, several times I've looked in a mirror in a store or something and wondered who that fellow was. And it turns out to be me. It was in Australia just before coming here in an airport in this bookstore. I was looking into this other section in the bookstore and there was this seedy character. Surely just off the boat. And of course it was myself. I kept looking. Do I look that bad? In any case, you know, there are these postcards with that you can turn either one way or the other. The reflection of the mountain is so clear and distinct in the lake that you can turn the picture either way. So, it's at nighttime, of course, breezeless, coming upon a breezeless patch of water with the moon shining in the reflection of the moon shining in the water. And that reflection of the moon appears to be a moon from every aspect. There is nothing about it that doesn't appear to be a moon. Actually, if you look in the mirror long enough, you see a face, somebody else's face in the mirror. We learn as children that this is just a mirror and so forth. I'm led into wanting to tell you a story about an old professor. When I was at college, I had to work my way through school, part of it, and there's an old English professor, very fine man, who had, in his old age had lapsed into word salad and was really in a bad state. From working with him, I determined that I would never become a professor. And he, one day, went up to a mirror that was on a door and stuck his hand up to the door, up to the mirror, and it hit against it, of course. So he opened the door and put his hand around to shake hands. So, the image of the moon shining in the lake appears to be a moon, but in no respect is a moon. No part of it is the moon, no, the collection of it at one time is not a moon. Collection of it over time is not a moon. There is nothing that is moon. In a similar way, it is said that beings appear to have a type of inherent existence or existence from their own side that they don't have. It's not that beings don't exist but appear to exist. Rather, the wisdom consciousness is to make a differentiation between mere existence and an over-concretized type of existence that is more subtle than the concretized type of existence already penetrated when one understands impermanence. What this is compared to is the sense of something covering its parts, that this picture, for instance, appears to, you know, just to our innate mind the way it is working, it appears to cover this spot. You know, if you say, where's the picture, you point to here. And what's at the end of your finger? there's something that covers from here to here. Now, Chandrakirti is advising that the yogi, the meditator, investigate with discriminating knowledge to determine whether there is any such entity that could cover from this spot to this spot. All within the context of realizing that we live our lives in the midst of such entities. I'm switching to water. This is apple juice. And I thought I'd try it out tonight. I get very dry when I talk. And I remembered once, it was at Harvard, in 1981, the Dalai Lama was giving a series of lectures over 5 days. There were two lectures every day for 5 days, an hour and a half, morning and afternoon. And I was drinking water, tea, anything that I could find. And I suggested one day that they put some honey in the tea because I could get some energy from it. And as I was just about to say what he had said, I took a sip. And it was so delicious, I forgot about what he said. So, just as that there appears to be a moon shining there, and you see you're not seeing water. The metaphor is not that you see water with a moon shining in it. You see a moon reflected in water, which is such that you only see sky and moon, you see? And if you look over that moon in every spot, there is no moon there. That's used as a metaphor for the absence of such inherent existence, concrete existence, existence from the object's own side, existence of the object in its own right. It's called ultimate existence. It's called existence by way of the object's own character. To realize that although objects appear to have that kind of existence, they don't. They are empty of that kind of existence, that kind of existence. Therefore, emptiness is extremely specific. It doesn't mean that the pitcher is empty of being a pitcher. It means that the pitcher is empty of such concrete existence or existence from its own side. Thus, one has to understand that of which phenomena are empty and well, either discover or talk oneself into it, that one has been conceiving phenomena to exist that way all the time. I'm joking about talking oneself into it. The system is saying that we live our lives within such conception about the existence of phenomena. And it has to be something that is innately misconceived. It cannot just be something that opposing philosophical systems superimpose on these phenomena. It cannot be something that we as we grow up through analysis and so forth add on to phenomena as we grow up. It has to be something that even animals, even people who don't know language and so forth, feel, conceive with respect to phenomena. It has to be something that appears even to sense consciousnesses. You know, there are these pictures where if you look at it in one way, it looks like one thing. If you look at it another way, it looks like another. And the one of the famous ones is of two chalices that are right next to each other. You see two chalices, and then just a moment later, you see two faces. And another story. It's the Life magazine series I thought would be good for a Tibetan school to have there, so I had it sent to Dharamsala in North India, I believe from the Ford Foundation. And one day I took one in on the mind to the Dalai Lama since he's interested in such things. And I said, what do you see? And he said right away, two chalices and two faces. I laughed and laughed and laughed. He said, what are you laughing at? I refused to tell him. In any case, this type of inherent existence, this type of the sense of the object as covering its parts, has to be something even that appears to sense consciousnesses. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness in the Buddhist way, they're called eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mental consciousness. The phenomena have to appear that way, and our mere assent to that appearance constitutes the agreement or conception that objects do exist so concretely. So by using the example of the moon, the reflection of the moon in the lake, and understanding that no part of it is a moon, no collection of it is a moon, and understanding how much non-moon can appear to be moon, then one extends that over to oneself, one's own body, mind, and other people's body and mind, to get a sense of how, even though phenomena do not exist in such a concrete way, they appear to. So there's a conflict between the mode of existence or mode of subsistence of phenomena and how they appear, a conflict between appearance and reality. And Chandrakirti is advising that the meditator understand that he or she, as well as all other beings, are trapped in a process of assenting to this false mode of appearance, a false mode, assenting to an appearance of a false mode of existence of phenomena and building important parts of the life around it. So similarly, the meditator is called, you know, when somebody cuts into your line and in the bank, and you want to yank them out of the way because they got in your way. Well, that you, that I at that time, so concrete. The Tibetan, that obviously isn't the Tibetan example. Maybe not, there are banks. Is of coming upon a pillar at night in the dark where you didn't expect it. And when you hit that pillar, the pillar forms and you form. And it said at that time you can get a sense of this over-concretized sense of self. Other suggestions are when somebody is particularly nasty to you and accuses you of having done something you haven't done, and the sense of, I didn't do that. I'll tell another story. In college, a Rhodes Scholar was our proctor, and he lived a few floors up above. I lived on the third floor, he lived on the fifth floor, and somebody had stolen the fellow's typewriter from across the hall. I actually didn't even know the fellow's name. It was pathetic on my own part. I suppose I shouldn't admit it. Talk about compassion. And this proctor showed up, a big fellow, you know, Rhodes Scholar, athlete, showed up in my room and he said, you stole it. Oh, was I angry. I can feel it until today. He ordered me up to his room, two flights up, and told me off. And I said, I don't even know the guy's name. And of course, then he was sure I had stolen it. So that over-concretized sense of self is that of which beings are empty. It's not that beings are empty of themselves, or that beings do not exist, or that Chandrakirti is asking meditators to understand that they do not exist, rather that to understand that they don't exist in the way they conceive themselves to. Now, the claim of this system is that all suffering, no matter what it is built on this type of misconception. I think it's relatively easy to see that some suffering is built on it. Very difficult to see that all suffering of any sort is built on this type of misconception. But that's the system. That because of assenting to this false appearance and being drawn into, because of that, desires, hatreds, and so forth, in order to fulfill this type of being, karmic latencies, the latencies of actions, or the potencies of actions, are deposited on the mind, and those make trouble for beings. So the claim is that when the actual status of phenomena is penetrated, and when it is penetrated by a meditative mind that is concentrated one-pointedly to the point where even analysis of this discriminating wisdom sort increases the stabilization of the mind. I mean, you have to admit, it's practically unheard of. You either stabilize and you get quiet and go to sleep and sink down. I mean, you stabilize usually down, it goes from laxity down to subtle lethargy, to coarse lethargy, to drowsiness, to sleep. Or you start analyzing and the mind moves more and becomes more and more unstable. Here the meditator first develops a very stable mind by doing one-pointed meditation and then alternates that with analysis such that supposedly in time the stabilizing type of meditation and the analytical meditation serve to assist each other rather than harm each other. This is a union of head and heart that is quite attractive to me, even as a object of speculation. That when one penetrates the nature of phenomena with such a vibrantly alive but stable mind, that one can realize it first inferentially, and then one can realize it directly, and then by entering into meditation over and over again for a very long period of time, and bringing this type of understanding into the structure of one's daily behavior, one can gradually overcome from the root any assent to this false type of appearance. Developing along the way all sorts of marvelous qualities about which I spoke in the beginning, like Chandrakirti's rainbow body and so forth. That is the system. So, one can see how the wisdom realizing selflessness or emptiness works hand in hand with compassion. Because, for instance, with this deepest level of wisdom, one understands that not only oneself, but other beings have this type of erroneous thought behind many of their actions. These actions putting karmic etchings into the mind, which become activated and draw that person into trouble. And from that point of view, having an even deeper sense of compassion, because one understands all the more the causes of suffering. And really, if the system is true, or even if it isn't true, if one perceives it to be so and penetrates, has such penetrating understanding, that person must undergo tremendously moving feelings, because the person would understand that this horror and suffering is unnecessary. Much like crazy people in the mental hospital, whom one understands need not undergo such pain if they could only understand such and such. as one of my friends said in college, I used to feel how easy it would be for other people to improve themselves until he tried it on himself. So in trying it on oneself in this Buddhist way that stems from the teachings of Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, with some commentary, Tibetan commentary thrown in, this is the way this Buddhist system seeks to overcome, at least lessen, the type of suffering that there is in one's own life and in other lives, and using that wisdom consciousness enhance to an even greater extent one's devotion to others' welfare. Thank you.
I'm going to congratulate Mrs. Namith and Dr. Hopkins. We've drawn an overflowing house, so if you will excuse us for a few minutes, we'll go and see those who have only had our voices, and we'll take a question or two there. We'll come back and take the rest of the questions and hear the thank yous. Excuse us just for a moment. Yes. Now behind you, just please speak loudly so that I can hear you and everybody else might.
Mr. Chairman, you would of course explain to the fire marshal he's not seeing reality. My question is, Dr. Jackson used the term impermanence. I was wondering if that is similar in meaning to the term relative state, and if in that case, if there's an absolute state, which a comment might be made. My other question is, when the speaker mentioned the word karma, not the word dharma, I would like to hear something about that.
Did everybody hear the question?
Your question was about impermanence and then also about dharma. I mentioned karma but not dharma. And with respect to impermanence, you're wondering if I had in mind that this is a relative state and that there might be some absolute state. Okay? Impermanence refers to the rapid disintegration of phenomena. This emptiness, this lack of inherent existence, is said to be permanent. But in this particular system, the emptiness, say, of this water pitcher depends upon the water pitcher. The water pitcher depends upon its emptiness. My body depends upon its emptiness of inherent existence. The emptiness of inherent existence of this body depends upon the body. They're mutually dependent. Therefore, even if that emptiness is a mere absence of inherent existence, and even if supposedly a wisdom consciousness can be generated that immortally knows this, that emptiness, even though it's permanent, is not an absolute, because it depends upon the phenomena of which it is their final nature. Then, with respect to dharma, the word dharma comes from the Sanskrit verbal root dhar, which means to hold. And in its widest usage, all of these phenomena are dharmas because they hold their own entities. It's a very wide usage of the word dharma. Dharma has 10 different meanings. Now, dharma as doctrine or as practice, or those as practice means those states of mind which, when one actualizes them, hold one back. You see, the root means to hold one back from suffering. So all of the practices that I was speaking about, compassion, wisdom, and so forth, are all dharmas in that sense.
Yeah?
In Western cultures, there are at least two beliefs about the newborn child. One is that the child is born in sin, and another belief is that the child is born void of any mental impressions. My question is, what is the oldest view of the newborn child with respect to his mental state and with respect to his spiritual state?
I'm going to summarize the question.
The question is that in the West there are two different views about the newborn child. One, that the newborn child is born in a state of sin with mental impressions, and another that it is not. And the questioner is wondering what the position in Buddhism is. In Buddhism, the wheel of cyclic existence has no beginning, even though when you make a wheel, you can say you begin making it from a certain point. If you just take the metaphor of a wheel, you can't say this is the beginning of the wheel. Therefore, the process of contaminated cyclic existence has been going on without beginning. And these mental impressions are brought from lifetime to lifetime, and therefore a child is born with millions of mental predispositions, impressions brought over from other lifetimes. And because cyclic existence is an unfavorable state, it is not the best situation. And then your second part of your question about the spiritual state of the child, it would depend upon the predispositions that are brought over from other lifetimes. But it is recognized that children do, as they develop their bodies and minds and their conceptuality, develop different types of minds, different attitudes as they progress during the lifetime. But the claim is that spiritual attainments and problems can be brought over from other lifetimes. Professor Ian Stevenson of my own university has done a lot of research in the field of reincarnation, written many books on the topic. And he was telling me recently, meaning a couple years ago, that some of his most recent research is concerned with people who claim to know their former lifetimes in the West, who died in some violent accident and have been born with a scar at that place. I'm just saying this is some of his current work.
This is the myth.
The question is whether the Buddhists have addressed the question of a total nuclear war and the possible annihilation of this planet, and whether there would be still perhaps some unseen type of life. The theory is that there are many world systems, and therefore if this one is blown up, the beings from here, driven by the force of their own karma, will be drawn to other places that are suitable in terms of the particular karma that's activated at that time. In other words, well, then to answer the question about whether, let's see, in my experience, I have not come upon, and with the people that I work with, I can't say that. On the possibility of total nuclear war in which this planet is totally destroyed, it fits in to the Buddhist theory of the arising of world systems, the disappearance of world systems into a vacuity, the reappearance of systems, and so forth. But you see, that leaves a gap with regard to this particular world system, but supposedly there are other world systems into which people would be born.
The back in the middle?
Yeah. Concerning the question about moon and reflecting on the peaceful lake, is there a way that the system you're describing suggests that we can see the moon directly or experience the moon directly rather than the reflection of the moon on the lake that we so often mistake as?
Let me just say one thing with regard to your question. This is supposed to be the era of weapons in the Buddhist way. But in the next Buddha is supposed to appear after many, many, I think it's millions of years, when the lifespan has degenerated to age 10. And it rises back up again, I forget until what age. And that the next Buddha who reveals himself the way this one did, engages in this open activities of such wide scale teaching, would appear after such a time. So on that theory, there shouldn't be a nuclear holocaust of such proportions that it would utterly destroy this planet for a long time. But I'm just. Yeah, it's absolutely no consolation. I'm sorry, your question about perceiving the moon directly?
Is there anything that the system would suggest that we can do to perceive the moon directly rather than as a reflection?
Did everybody hear the question?
He's wondering if there's any way we can see the moon directly rather than by means of the reflection. Now, I don't want to be facetious, but they obviously accept that you can go outside and look up instead of down. So I'm not quite sure what you're getting at. Do you mean perceive the reality directly rather than through an image?
I understood the example to mean that we had mistaken the reflection of the moon on the lake to be we had mistaken that for the reality.
No, the reflection of the moon on the lake is used as a metaphor, only an example that's easy to understand, so that once one understands that, one can apply that understanding to the more difficult problem of how all of these phenomena appear. So the reflection of a moon on a lake could appear to be just a moon. In the third example, but is not. So that's the example. That's easy to understand. It appears to be a moon, but is not. There's a conflict between appearance and reality. then, with a much more difficult problem, these phenomena appear to exist in their own right. But the claim is that they do not exist in their own right. It's not that they appear to exist but don't exist. It's that they appear to exist in their own right, independent of their parts, independent of a perceiving subject, etc., but they don't. Okay? Does that help? No.
There's a question here at the back of the first section.
What would be the end to a cyclical development?
Oh, yes.
If an individual goes through a cyclical life, how does it get out? How did it get into?
Now, the question is, if our type of life is being posited as a cyclic, how did we get into it, and how can one get out of it? There's a very convenient answer for the system about how we got into it. It's simply that we've always been in it. There is no beginning, like the wheel. There's no beginning to this process of cyclic existence. Thus, our type of life doesn't depend upon this planet, but depends upon other world systems in which one could live since beginningless time. Now, I have to admit, it's a very convenient answer. It just means there's no problem because we've always been that way. Now, with respect to getting out of cyclic existence, the process is, in its fullest form, is built around developing compassion to its utmost and developing these three types of wisdom to their utmost. Three types of compassion, three types of wisdom. The three wisdoms being of the nature of this, of the nature and extent of the suffering that we are in. And then number two, the impermanent nature of anything that is produced. And number three, the emptiness or absence of such an over-concretized type of existence. That when these three types of compassion are enhanced by the three types of wisdoms, and when one has a meditative, very strong, one-pointed, alert, joyful consciousness that is meditating these topics, that through long meditation it's possible to overcome the process. Thus, cyclic existence is said to have no beginning, but to have an end. Then at the end of cyclic existence, it doesn't mean that the being ends. It just means that the being has been purified. The mind and body of the being have been purified. And then the being can act more effectively to carry out this compassionate motivation with respect to others. Chandrakirti compares compassion to a seed in the beginning, in that it is what is going to grow forth this harvest of freedom from cyclic existence. He compares it to water in the middle because it nourishes and develops this plant of Buddhahood. And in the end, he compares it to the state of ripeness of Buddhahood in which one actively acts to help others effectively.
We have two more questions. Let's see how many questions we have. All right. Tate, you presumed your position.
With respect to the gentleman's question here.
Yes.
When you say that a good analogy would be the reality would be the experience in any attempt to explain, observe, analyze, think about, talk about that experience is the illusion or the appearance.
In this particular system, he's wondering, did everyone hear? I perhaps don't need to repeat. Do I? Yes, I do need to. He's wondering if reality is the experience and that any conceptualization, analysis, observation, and so forth would be the illusion. In this particular system that I'm talking from, conceptuality, analysis, observation, and so forth are the very means for getting out of the mess that one is in. So control conceptuality, control discrimination, controlled analysis is the means of penetrating the false mode of appearance that phenomena have, be it that they're more lasting than they actually are, or be it that they seem to cover their parts whereas they don't. In other words, the teeming of a stabilized mind that is controlled with an analytical mind that investigates, analyzes, conceptualizes, uses observation and so forth is what is stressed. So the mere stopping of thought, you see, would only leave you with the basic false appearance. It wouldn't leave you with reality.
Since Buddhism is a major religion in the world, probably is claimed by a quarter to a third of the world's population, what effect does it have on the common person? In other words, if I'm in a country that has the largest number who are Buddhists, how would a Buddhist look different than somebody who isn't a Buddhist?
The question is, if Buddhism is a world religion and is claimed by so many adherents, say a quarter of the world's population or so, how could one tell the difference between a Buddhist and a non-Buddhist? Well, I thought of a facetious reply at first, which is if you saw someone with a rainbow body, you'd be certain he was a Buddhist. No. I don't think that from the outside people would necessarily look any different. Some of the people I have met who have embodied, who to my sight embody Buddhist principles, have a strength, a warmness, a compassion, and so forth. But I see very much the same qualities in some very good Christians that I know, John Cobb, say, Professor John Cobb, was just out at a conference in Hawaii and was tremendously impressed with his person. So I think from the outside it would be very difficult to tell.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask Dr. Dan Overmeyer, the acting head of the Department of Religious Studies, to thank our speaker. But before I do that, I must announce that the Vancouver Sun Annual Lecture will be given by Dr. Condoleezza Rice. I don't know if we settled the topic before Mr. Andropov died, but it's entitled East-West Security Prospects for Peace. Dr. Rice is professor of political science at Stanford, an assistant director of the Center for International Security and Arms Control. She's a consultant to the RAND Corporation on Soviet security policy. Her academic specialty is international security and Soviet East-West European policy. That's February 25th, 1984. Dr. Dan Overmeyer, who is the acting head of the Department of Religious Studies, is going to thank our speaker.
Thank you. In Zen Buddhism, one way to describe an enlightened practitioner is to say that he has gone to the other side and now has come back to this side. Well, I submit that Jeffrey Hopkins, at the level of scholarship, has done just that. He has gone to the other side and learned with great precision, wisdom, and compassion the inner workings of a system which is quite foreign to those in the culture in which he grew up. I think he's a tribute to the whole discipline of the history of religions, the scientific study of religion that, to me at least, is tremendously important in this day and age as we try to deal with this whole area of very important human motivation and behavior. So on behalf of the University of British Columbia and also of the Department of Religious Studies. I want to thank you, Jeffrey, for your work and your demonstration of how to do the job. Thank you very much.